Our talk this morning will be given by Boundless Way priest and senior Dharma teacher, and also our Shuso, head of practice for our retreat, Laura Wallace.
So here we are in the middle of the, our beginning, the second week, or sort of in the middle. I've lost track. and it doesn't matter. We're all here. So continuing this investigation into Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So this morning I would like to share some thoughts about this first chapter that's in the second section. This book is so very conveniently divided into three sections, and our coming and going sesshin is 3 weeks, and so we have been looking into each a section each week, holding that loosely. This first chapter in this section is called The Single-Minded Way. And there were several things that leapt off the pages and touched my heart. And so I want to talk about them. So, Suzuki Roshi talks about the Bodhisattva's way as the single-minded way. And he says, her way is in each moment to express her nature and her sincerity. This is the single-minded way. Her way is in each moment to express her nature and her sincerity. Quite a thing. And of course, all of us bodhisattvas here today practicing this single-minded way. He talks about, of course, Zazen being one of these expressions of the single-minded way, but not the only one. I think it's, I actually got quite a smile on my face when he said, you know, he loves to sit, it's very clear, he loves to sit Zazen, and he says, I want to just sit, but I encourage myself to practice in other ways too. I think maybe I bow, and then maybe to recite the sutras and so on. And he talks about other ways in which we express ourselves in activity. And he particularly points to cooking. And he says, so when you cook, you should express yourself in your activity in the kitchen. You should allow yourself plenty of time. You should work on it with nothing in your mind and without expecting anything. You should just cook. That is also an expression of our sincerity, a part of our practice. I would just say this is our practice. So this just cooking. Just eating, just walking, just breathing. just suffering. It sounds very simple, and it is. I notice as I sit that my mind likes to complicate things. Breathing right? Should it be deeper, shallower? Is it deep enough? Hara? Or is it in my chest? Yeah. When we walk, just to put one foot in front of the other. But I actually find this practice of just breathing, just walking, just suffering, very difficult. My mind often tries to do many things at the same time, or at least it thinks it does. It actually is only doing very quickly multiple things, but it feels sometimes like it's going in multiple things at the same time. And of course, this is a popular culture. They call this multitasking. And this was also something that was highly prized and rewarded in my career. Encouraged quite often to multitask. When you're doing this, already be thinking about the next thing. And then two more after that. And so this encouragement and this instruction that he gives to us of just this, just cook, just breathe, just suffer. I recently saw that it's very difficult for me to simply suffer and to suffer simply. I saw it again, I should say. Many stories arise for me around suffering. I usually look for someone to blame for my suffering, or someone or something to blame for my suffering. And I make up all kinds of stories, and if only this, if only that, then this wouldn't be so hard, so painful. And this teaching that Suzuki Roshi holds up, just suffer when it's time to suffer. Just suffer, simply. For me, this often arises as when it's time to cry, just cry. Can be challenging. All kinds of messages from the world about when it's appropriate to cry and when it's not, when it's okay to show our emotions and when it's not. I feel often that this Zen practice is about unlearning much of the conditioning that I have had in my life. All of the things that I was taught to push away or maybe push over there, away from myself. Yeah. Simply to be human. And we talk about this great freedom, this liberation. This freedom amid suffering, not from suffering. My life has challenges and difficulties, joy and pain, sadness and happiness, all the entire spectrum of human life. And of course, easy to imagine that we have this freedom amid the wonderful things, the joy and laughter and happiness. Of course, when we look deeply, we see that that freedom there can be elusive as we grab onto things that we want them to stay. And we begin to suffer because, of course, they have to go too. This great coming and going, always. This universe and us coming and going, constantly coming and going, constantly. This freedom amidst the coming and going. Such a gift. The other thing that struck me deeply was his instruction that about allowing yourself plenty of time. Speaking specifically about cooking here, but I heard it as a much broader instruction for me. This also I find very, very difficult. At least that's the story I have. That there is not enough time for me to give myself plenty of time. I have always been an extremely curious person, and I have always been interested in so many things, and I want to do them all. This has been with me since as long as I can remember. And of course, the limitations of time, 24 hours a day, you know, there isn't time to do everything that I want to do. So I grabbed on with great enthusiasm to time management when it was presented as a concept. And I worked very hard at it, and I refined it so that I could put something into every single slice of time that I have. And here, Suzuki Roshi says, you should allow yourself plenty of time. Whoa. What a teaching, what an instruction for me. To look at the stories that I have around that. As I can't arises, and what does that mean? And do I have to believe it? And then what arose for me around this also was this bigger enough time for this Buddhist practice. So easy to make up a story about the timetable that things should unfold. I'm going to go on Shasin, and this will happen, and then and so on, you know, we have it all, we see it all. In our minds, we think we know how things will unfold and what it will mean. And I felt quite a relief with this encouragement, because what arose for me was plenty of time. I have the rest of my life, however long that is. I have the rest of my life to practice. No rush, no special place to get to. Plenty of time. Oh, such a relief. No goal. I also wanted to pick up on a thread that David talked about last night about something else mentioned in this talk that Suzuki Roshi gave about this thing itself, just this. No preparing for it. Just it itself. So beautifully expressed. And so I realize I don't need to prepare to breathe. I don't have to remind my body or my lungs what to do. No preparation necessary. Just to move into whatever is here, to receive whatever is here. This is it. No preparation required. Of course, in the world of form, I greatly appreciate preparation. If I were going to have brain surgery, I would very much want the brain surgeon who would be working on me to have done a lot of preparation. Yeah, right. And so holding these two truths. And I think finally, Suzuki Roshi talks about appreciation in this little talk and that he gave. And, you know, again, easy to make it into something we must do or remember to do or a thing, turn it into a thing. Am I doing it right? And easy to appreciate the beautiful purple tulips on the altar. Easy to appreciate the sunlight on the floor. Sometimes harder to appreciate the state of our world, the horrors in the news, pain and suffering. That is everywhere. The things that happen to us that don't go so well. And sometimes appreciation arises by itself, I would say often, if not always. And not always in the timetable, again, that we would wish. I was in a very bad accident many, many years ago and took a long time to recover and always looked at it as a bad thing that had happened. And then, I don't even remember when or why or how, something arose and all of a sudden I could see the gift that it was. How lucky I was to see it. Maybe I never would have. That would have been okay too. Not in charge of how and when these things arise. So, this bodhisattva way, I will just leave us with the final encouragement. Even if the sun were to rise from the west, the bodhisattva has only one way. This way is in each moment to express our nature and our sincerity. Thank you. So, inviting everyone to sit comfortably and come forth and down the dialogue, questions, comments.
very much.
So many things struck me about your talk, and I love the bit about unlearning. And I feel like I'm unlearning some of these habits and rules, and it's kind of scary. But it feels good and kind of freeing too at the same time. The other thing that I wanted to comment on is...
Can you hear down there?
Yeah.
Just a little louder.
Yeah, okay. Louder. Express myself louder. All right. The taking enough time, you know, with cooking. And I just really loved that little bit. And I always get, I often get harsh with myself because things take me too long. That's not okay. I need to be quicker and also perfect about it too, you know? And what a wonderful idea that I could take more time, as much time as is needed. And it's just the expression of myself is as important as the product. Mm-hmm. That's maybe a little hope that I hold out there. That's held out with that.
Yeah. It's so touching what you're saying, Carol. To I bet not just me. This idea, you know, that I could just do things and it wouldn't have to be perfect. And to really give myself the time. I wanted to talk about that a little bit too, because I had an experience this morning where I had to get something done really fast because the time kept compressing. And so I also want to speak for giving oneself enough time. Sometimes there actually isn't enough, I'm putting air quotes here, time. You know, but there always is enough time. That's the thing, there actually is. And we don't have to make that time. So the example is that we have a teacher's meeting every day just before the sutra service, and we try to end and give ourselves time because we have a lot of things to do. And David asked me to lead the chanting and pick out instruments, and then something else came up, and we needed to attend to that. And then something else came up, I needed to attend with Laura, and then Steve asked me to talk about something. And I actually was able to say to Steve, we'll talk later, made the space. But I had 3 minutes to set up. And I was thinking, I like to use 15 minutes, 10 minutes. And as I went around placing instruments in front of everybody, Fran came up to me and said, could I play the drum? And it just like was... Yes. So the point I'm making is that I had an idea of me doing something. But actually the doing was being done by the whole community. And that's what I forget. I forget. I think I'm in charge of the universe. I'm sure I'm not alone. Well, I hope you don't think I'm in charge. I don't have to blame. But it is this quality of also letting ourselves be held by each other. And I think you said this other important thing, that it doesn't have to be perfect. So there's enough time, and, you know.
Yeah, that notion of give yourself plenty of time. I know. Time is such a koan for our culture, right? We have really boxed ourselves in, and we really think we know what it is. And we spend most of our lives being busy. Now, what is it? How can you be busy? I mean, really, there's just one thing after the other. But there's a way that we create this mental world and we say, oh, I'm really busy. And we live in the mental construction of busy, of not enough time. Mm-hmm. And we suffer and we say, oh, if only there were more time. Mm-hmm. So this give yourself plenty of time, so many ways to take it. And one way is say, this is important and I'm going to do it. And other people may or may not be happy. It might fit in or not fit in. So that's one wonderful way to play with this freedom. You know who's in charge of your life. It's not somebody else. So how do we do that? And then this other side of how do we appreciate the time being?
Mm.
So plenty of time to cook. Maybe 20 minutes before the soup has to go on and the bell's going to ring. So how to have plenty of time moving quickly around the kitchen. That is all the time in the world. So this give yourself plenty of time. It's not just, it's wonderful to go slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great practice to slow things down. And it's a great practice to just do it.
Mm-hmm.
To find the plenty of time. Sometimes we do very short interviews, sometimes on the last day of retreat. And we say they have to be brief and to the point, but there's plenty of time. Maybe 30 seconds. But a whole lifetime. So to be careful about not getting caught in one side or another. Like, I just have to... but how when we walk quickly, when we follow our jiki all over the building in the afternoon, how can we take our time moving quickly through the building and appreciate our life there?
Yeah. I want to say one more thing about this, because I'm really happy to hear you say that, because I'd forgotten until you said that in my example, as I was walking down the stairs and saw that I had 3 minutes, I actually forced myself to go slower,
mm-hmm.
not to rush, right? And somebody gave me a koan years ago that wasn't from the Japanese Zen tradition. It was from the Eastern European Jewish tradition, and I really didn't understand it for years and years and years. And I think the words are more or less, when you're on your way somewhere, go fast. And when you realize that you're late, slow down. And something happened the other night here where somebody who's often late came in and was really scattered and kind of running around. And I got to talk to him and say that very thing. You know, when you're late, slow down. Like if the sutra service hadn't started at 10 o'clock, nobody would have died. Probably 99.9% chance that nobody would have died. So there's also that part of it, mm-hmm. right? Once you know you're not going to make it, you're not going to get it in on time, you're not going to get the meal ready on time, there's something about going, okay. But before that, just do it. So maybe you don't understand the koan either, but it took me 20 years to understand it. So. Yes?
This is very familiar territory for me also, and I'm going to add one thing that's not always obvious. Very often giving ourselves time is a sort of discipline which part of us resents. But after receiving the Lifetime Workaholic Award, I sort of stumbled into a space where I still do my job, but there's elements of rebellion, of resentment, of lots of elements that bring us to this point. But I can tell you, so accidentally, I've discovered a sense of luxuriating in time, of the luxury of time, of doing one's work in a way that allows one's imagination to run free. So what I'm saying is that I've stumbled onto the rewards of doing exactly what Shunro Suzuki recommends, and it's just really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So try it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful practice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and how
until this very moment. So.
Yeah. How to luxuriate in long time and slow time?
Right.
I think that's. Mm-hmm. I love where you're pointing with that, and it's wonderful to work hard, and it's wonderful to be efficient. It can be. I love to watch the short order cooks at a diner. Or something. three eggs on, one hand here. There's a beauty of the dance, and there doesn't have to be any rushing at all. Plenty of time.
It's just fast.
But
it's not rushing.
When you give up the tyranny of time, all of that efficiency also emerges.
Well, and you know, the other part that's important about this is before you came to this clarity and you were feeling resentment and all the other feelings, that too is part of our practice. Mm-hmm. Not to think that we should be beyond resentment, beyond feeling oppressed, beyond feeling rushed. That this practice, and Suzuki Roshi is really clear about this, the feeling of resentment, the feeling of rushing, the feeling of anxiety, that is the Buddha nature manifesting itself as that. There's no loopholes, right? There's no way out. Yeah. So always you've been doing this.
Sure. Jason and Shane.
I think your comment about when you're late, slow down is going to inform what I'm saying a little bit. But what I was thinking is that today, in some jobs, things do need to be roughly perfect. And in, you know, the nature of capitalism, or whatever you call it, and international competition is so intense. I think that's why multitasking, one of the reasons multitasking has become, I mean, in a sense, it's a way of getting more out of a person if you can have monitoring of multiple different things at the same time. So it's like it's there. And I wonder if it requires, if you're going to do a practice like this, if it does require that you change your lifestyle, kind of like right livelihood, or if there's a way to actually put it into these jobs. Does, you know, is, you know, through mindfulness, say, or let's just call it that, when you're working, does your efficiency really improve or not? I don't know. So I guess I sometimes feel like if you just say, like, slow down, like, whatever you're doing, not slow down, but it doesn't actually, it's not realistic in today's world, I think, sometimes. But the rushing thing, like, I think maybe that's because obviously our minds aren't geared to do all this multitasking, and so I think we kind of get into a panic in some way, in an anxiety and a panic, and that can affect efficiency. So that's where the trade-off might be with you know, mindfulness. In a sense, you're maybe doing one task and the other, but it's with a greater efficiency and a greater maybe effectiveness. Or so I'm not sure what I'm asking exactly, but I. You have thoughts on what I've been saying?
I do. Do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, thank you very much. I just want to pick up on something that you said that my heart went, yes, right? Which is, you pointed out that, you know, we're not actually made to do this multitasking. So, I have read this, you know, confirmed by science, that our brains don't work that way. We're not actually built as human beings to do multiple things at the same time. We think we are, but actually what science tells us is that's not what's happening. And I actually found that really reassuring, to find out that we as humans are built to do exactly what Suzuki Roshi is and all of our teachers here are pointing to, which is just this, you know. Please add.
Well, and that when we think we're multitasking, what it looks like, you know, it's never a proven fact in science, but what it looks like is that our attention is rapidly moving from one thing to another, so fast that it's really exhausting.
Yeah.
And that's part of why we burn out, you know, in those situations. But one of the things that you mentioned that I think is important here So the world is kind of set up this way right now. And we do have a choice to perceive when the setup that we happen to be inside of is not healthy for us. And then we get to make a choice, can I help to transform the system, which some people do, or is this system maybe too much and I need to step out? And speaking very personally, I worked for 20 years for an organization that taught mindfulness that was so stressful. There was time pressure and trying to make money and do all this stuff. There was never enough time, and I would come home exhausted. And it took me a while to figure out. I tried to change it from within, and I didn't have the capacity as one human being. So one of the things I learned from that, I did eventually leave. One of the things I learned was, this is connected to a very important teaching of the Buddha's, the original teachings of the Buddha, where he says the most important thing in spiritual life is to have good friends. Mm. Kalyanamitta, he calls it. So if we're in a situation that's very stressful, we have to look around at the people there. And are these people that we can connect to and maybe transform the situation? Or maybe not. And it behooves us to go into a place where everyone or most of the people we're working with value the kinds of things we're talking about. So there's no rule book. This is not black and white. This is very personal, very particular. It's like in a family, each person sees the family differently. So this is again about view. And the other thing I also wanted to mention was that you brought up right livelihood. So the Buddha also taught that there's suffering, and there's the cause of suffering, which is wanting things to be different. And then there's the possibility of being free in the midst of suffering, which we call nirvana. We've been talking about that. And then these are the Four Noble Truths. The fourth one is this Eightfold Path, because there's actually stuff to do. There are decisions to make. I'm going to have a job where I can live these teachings, as much as I can. Some of us are very privileged and we get to make those choices. Others of us have less of a choice, so that the choice resides inward rather than outward. But I think anyone who gets touched by the Dharma, we do have to make decisions constantly. Is this what I can live with if I have any choice in the matter? And sometimes the choice is very small. It might be just taking an extra breath in the middle of things, right? It's not making big changes. So this is, it's not black and white. There's no guidebook. But I think the practice helps us to see where we can make little changes that lead to big changes in our lives and the lives of others. And I guess that leads me to think that in terms of what's happening right now in the world politically, the same thing holds true. That it's very important for us to make little changes that we can do that are then accepted by a group we're in. Like, I think of the eco-sattva work that we're doing in Bamaswe Zen. The fact that we are using ecological cleaning products. Every time I use a tissue now, the box says, you've saved, 100,000 trees? And I go, yeah. But it's little tiny things like that that are important.
And I guess the one thing I want to address is this process versus product. Mm-hmm. So we talk a lot about this is it. So and Dogen says for the cook, when you're cooking, you're just cooking. But that doesn't mean that the product is not important. That to work skillfully, to really care about the outcome, is very different than perfectionism. So if I'm making a pot and it has to be perfect, that's a certain mind view that will I be good enough, versus making a pot and doing it wholeheartedly and really wanting to create a beautiful pot. And the joy of doing good work. And it's really not an either or, because if we just say, well, it doesn't really matter if the dishes get clean because it's so beautiful. Right? No, the dishes need to be clean. Mm. The kitchen needs to be clean, and that keeps us grounded here. And that there are consequences to our work. If we don't do our job well, then we have to take the consequences and bear them. And in each moment, we have to just be here, just making the soup, just making the pot. And so it's not one, not two. So important, we can get lost on either side. So we can really care about the cleaning we do, like really take care with the floor, with the cushions, and still not be attached to the outcome. When the bell rings, we stop. So this middle way seems important. Mm-hmm. Seamus, yeah.
Thank you for talk. And especially because I know I can give myself the freedom to liberate myself from multitasking. and leave it to the women, since they are better at it than the men.
Are you serious? Actually, I just felt such a hit right then. Are you serious?
Am I what?
Serious.
No, I'm not.
Thank
serious.
You. Good.
Serious. I was following that and then cracking something else. It was about something immediate being a part of much of my work for a long time. It was the capacity to see ahead or see behind corners or see things before they happen. And so I worked a lot in problem solving. So, but now, you said something at the end about nature. I heard it, and it was gone. And the question that took its place was, how do I know what to follow? I know it's not going to, I'm not following multitasking. How do I know what to follow? So I spent a lot of my life following because I'm good at it. Or somebody said I was good at it. Or something like this. How do I know what to follow? What's the nature that I follow? How do I recognize it? How do I decide?
So these are, once again, you bring up such wonderful questions, you know, because each one of us is choosing a moment after moment. What do I choose to follow? Do I choose to follow that familiar pathway of the thoughts? Do I choose to follow my breath? Do I choose? So I think the aliveness of that question is wonderful for us all.
Mm-hmm. And there's no real way to know. We never have enough information. So we just step forward into the unknown again and again and again.
And while on retreat, we just follow the schedule. Sit for a few more breaths.